Hello, this is Lincoln, reading from the Decatur Herald Tribune for Friday, January 3rd, 2025. Toastmasters International's 100 Years of Service Forged by One Illinois Wesleyan Grad. Byline Drew Zimmerman from January 2nd, 2025. Daryl Felty, a normal retiree, said he was first involved with Toastmasters International as a job requirement while interning at State Farm 26 years ago. At first, Felty believed he would be the one teaching members of the nonprofit, which has been improving the leadership and public speaking skills of its members for decades. But it didn't take long for him to realize there was more he could learn. Although it started as an obligation, Felty would participate in 16 different clubs across the Bloomington Normal community and continue to get a thrill out of helping other people. If you ever think you'll need to ask your boss for a raise, that's pretty important, and you better say something worthwhile, Felty said. You need Toastmasters to practice, and we will help you indirectly get that raise. For the last century, Toastmasters International has existed on the mission statement of providing a supportive and positive learning experience in which members are empowered to develop communication and leadership skills, resulting in greater self-confidence and personal growth. However, none of it would be possible without the perseverance of one Illinois Wesleyan University graduate who spent two decades making Toastmasters a reality. Today, the organization has over 360,000 members in more than 16,800 clubs in 143 countries. In central Illinois, there are 10 different clubs in the Bloomington Normal area, several of which are partnerships with State Farm, another 10 in the Peoria area, 5 in the Springfield area, 2 in the Decatur area, and 1 in Effingham. Club origins. After graduating from IWU in 1903, Toastmasters International founder Ralph C. Smedley stayed in central Illinois and became an executive director for the Bloomington YMCA, which was originally at the corner of Main and Market Streets. While there, Smedley realized some of the high school-aged boys needed help with their communication. To improve their public speaking, Smedley organized weekly meetings where students could make short speeches and be evaluated on them in a friendly setting. Because of these meetings' resemblance to banquets and after-dinner occasions requiring a celebratory toast, the group became known as a Toastmasters Club. And there's a picture here of Ralph C. Smedley, who was the founder of Toastmasters International speaking organization. Smedley eventually took a promotion that relocated him to Freeport, where he launched another club that piqued the interest of older generations of business professionals. This took him all the way from Rock Island to San Jose, California. But whenever Smedley would leave a community, clubs would have a habit of fizzling out. This was until Smedley's YMCA career took him to Santa Ana, California, where he formed another Toastmasters club in 1924. From then on, Toastmasters' uninterrupted history was forged. By the time of Smedley's death in 1965, Toastmasters had expanded from a single club with 24 members to 6,900 clubs with 150,000 members. Before his death, Smedley acknowledged that there must have been a need for such an instrument of service. Adaptability. Toastmasters clubs typically hold three styles of meetings: in person, virtual, and a hybrid of the two. The virtual style became necessary to keep club members connected through the COVID-19 pandemic. However, some directors see an advantage to this format. The silver lining for everything is that we've now been able to expand to where we've had people from all over the world attend our meetings, and it's really opened us up to different cultures, said Gary Vaughn, director for District 54 of Toastmasters International, which represents clubs across northern and central Illinois. Dick Poirier joined the Bridge Builders Club out of Plainfield while employed with the Chicago Bridge and Iron Company, and it continues to meet virtually following the pandemic. In doing so, it has managed to get members in Nevada, Minnesota, and as far away as Belgium to participate. However, Poirier hopes to return to a hybrid format soon, so there is an opportunity for members to socialize before and after a meeting. And there's a picture of President Sherry DeLeonardis opening a meeting of the Four Seasons Toastmasters in Bloomington Normal on December 16th, 2024. It's not that online is bad, Poirier said. It's different. At the Four Seasons Toastmasters Club, which holds hybrid meetings every first and third Monday at the Bloomington Normal YMCA, President Sherry DeLeonardis opens meetings with the night's theme and word of the day. The theme of the club's December 16th meeting was the holidays, which prompted DeLeonardis to share a brief history of the traditions of Christmas, Hanukkah, and Kwanzaa. This was followed by one of the staples of a Toastmasters meeting, prepared speeches. This week's speech was delivered by Jennifer Caldwell, who shared her experiences with the Innovative Planning Project, a five-level pathway offered by Toastmasters to build public speaking and leadership skills. And there's a lovely picture of Jennifer Caldwell. You can learn so much about being an officer and also contributing your skills to this awesome club, Caldwell said. And remember that you're unique and your leadership is different from everyone else's, and it's going to look different. Attendees then evaluate the speech based on a number of criteria. To ensure that everyone has an opportunity to work on their public speaking skills, Toastmasters meetings also feature table topics, a long-standing tradition that helps members organize their thoughts quickly on an impromptu subject. Participants have 1 to 2 minutes to express their thoughts on the given subject. Topics for this activity during the Four Seasons Toastmasters Club's December 16th meeting focused on the holidays, such as what club members wanted for Christmas. Local impact. Dan Woods, a self-employed leadership coach with 35 years of experience in hospital administration, joined the Effingham Toastmasters Club about 10 years ago after delivering a keynote speech at a Chamber of Commerce event. He was approached after the event by club founder and longtime Effingham resident Dale Fitzpatrick. Although he was approached to offer his expertise, Woods said he quickly realized there was more he could learn through his work with Toastmasters. Whether professionally or as part of a civic club or volunteer club or parent group, it's a great way to practice in front of a supportive, friendly group of people who are there for just the same reason, Woods said. As much as Toastmasters is focused on communication, Woods said, there is an equal focus on leadership, and many members have managerial or executive roles. And then there's a picture of Jennifer Caldwell presenting a speech at the Four Seasons Toastmasters meeting. Woods said one member was the mid-level manager of an area company who needed to give a presentation to his board of directors on a capital equipment purchase. And although other members could not give advice on the technical aspects of the speech, the club offered an encouraging environment ahead of the presentation. He was much more relaxed and felt he could really pay attention to what was important to his company instead of being in his head like a lot of us are when we have to give a talk or speech, Woods said. Poirier said the Chicago Bridge and Iron Company would pay half of the dues of employees who participated in the Bridge Builders Club. His involvement eventually landed him a position as an international district and board member of Toastmasters International between 2004 and 2006. This role took him around the world to South America, Indonesia, China, and other locations. Poirier said he visited a lot of places with a clear language barrier, but even something as innocuous as a hand gesture could be perceived as aggressive. To be able to communicate well, you have to understand the cultures, Poirier said. In his local roles, Poirier says he still witnesses progress by members of Toastmasters. A few years ago, a Chicago Bridge and Iron employee he would see in the hallways was convinced to come to Toastmasters. Within a year, she went from keeping her head down when she walked past others to holding a position with president in the title. She had it in her, Poirier said. She just didn't have the confidence. U.S. Congress. Why Mike Johnson's bid to remain House Speaker could be a struggle despite Trump's support. There's a picture of House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana. Washington. Mike Johnson is fighting for his political life again. The Louisiana Republican's hold on the House Speaker's gavel and his position as second in line to the presidency will be tested Friday when a new Congress convenes and House Republicans weigh whether to re-elect him to the post. The challenge, as always, is that Johnson will need almost every Republican vote to win. Johnson has a singular asset in his favor. President-elect Donald Trump endorsed him for Speaker in a social media post at the start of the week. But it's uncertain whether Trump's blessing will be enough to persuade far-right Republicans who have at times grown frustrated with Johnson's leadership and who are prone to demand concessions when their votes become essential. Johnson, 52, ascended to the speakership in October 2023, almost by accident, after Republicans struggled to replace Kevin McCarthy, following the unprecedented removal of the California Republican from the job. Several contenders tried and failed before Republicans settled on Johnson, who was well-liked across the conference. But Johnson's handling of major funding fights, including passage of aid to Ukraine last spring, and most recently a short-term spending bill, has turned at least a few allies into detractors. With Republicans holding a narrow 220 to 215 majority in the House, it would take only two GOP lawmakers voting for other candidates to deny Johnson a majority for the speakership, forcing more rounds of voting. Electing a speaker is the first order of business for the House after a new session of Congress begins at noon. It's a vote that members take even before being sworn into office. The House cannot organize until it has a speaker because that person effectively serves as the House's presiding officer and the institution's administrative head. The House can elect a new speaker at any time if the person occupying that role dies, resigns, or is removed from office. The speakership has been vacant only 13 times in U.S. history, according to the nonpartisan Congressional Research Service. No speaker had ever been removed until eight Republicans joined with Democrats to oust McCarthy. Barring those instances, a speaker is normally elected at the start of a new Congress and serves in the job for the full two-year session. The House clerk presides over the speaker's election. Lawmakers call out the name of their choice for speaker from the floor, a rare and time-consuming roll call that heightens the drama on the floor. Members often liven up the proceedings by shouting or standing when casting their vote. Any name can be called out from the House floor. While it has been the tradition for the Speaker to be a member of the House, it is not required. In past years, Democratic President Joe Biden, Trump, and even a senator, Republican Rand Paul of Kentucky, have received votes for House Speaker. None received a majority of the vote. And generally, a party's official nominee for Speaker is who ends up with the gavel. Republicans chose Johnson as their nominee for Speaker in a closed-door vote in November. A week later, Democrats unanimously chose Representative Hakeem Jeffries, Democrat of New York, to remain their leader despite the party's electoral losses. Lawmakers are not obliged to vote for their party's nominated candidate, and that is why the process can quickly get messy. Once the House is in a quorum, meaning the minimum number of members are present to proceed, nominating speeches will be made on behalf of the nominees for Speaker. The clerk appoints lawmakers from each party as tellers to tally the votes before the roll call begins. To become Speaker, a candidate needs a majority of the votes from House members who are present and voting. Historically, the magic number has been 218 out of the 435 members of the House. But many previous speakers, including McCarthy, have won with fewer votes because members sometimes vote present instead of calling out a name. Every lawmaker voting present lowers the overall tally needed to reach a majority. It remains to be seen whether Johnson will reach a majority to become Speaker on the first ballot. Should he come up short, it is likely the clerk will move to start another roll call vote. McCarthy went through a grueling 15 ballots over 4 days before he gained enough support to become the 55th Speaker in January 2023. Once a Speaker candidate wins a majority of those present and voting, the clerk will announce the results of the election. A bipartisan committee, usually consisting of members from the home state of the chosen candidate, will escort the speaker-elect to the chair on the dais where the oath of office is administered. The oath is identical to the one new members will take once a speaker is chosen. The outgoing speaker usually joins the successor at the speaker's chair, where the gavel is passed as a nod to the peaceful transition of power from one party leader to another. But this time around, given that Johnson is already the Speaker, it will likely be Jeffries who would once again hand Johnson the gavel. Public safety. New Orleans barriers to prevent vehicle attacks were in the process of being replaced. Byline: Christopher Weber, Jeff Martin, and Kevin McGill, Associated Press. There's a picture showing emergency vehicles and to keep other vehicles out of the French Quarter. New Orleans. 7 years ago, New Orleans officials began installing adjustable barriers at intersections in the famed French Quarter to temporarily prevent vehicles from entering the tourist area where the narrow streets are typically teeming with pedestrians every night. But the steel columns known as bollards were in the process of being replaced and were not engaged early on New Year's Day when a motorist rammed a pickup truck through a crowd of revelers, killing at least 15 people. The project to remove and replace the bollards along about 8 blocks of bustling Bourbon Street, from St. Ann Street to Canal Street, began November 18th, city records show. Temporary asphalt patches were installed in the spots where the steel columns were removed, according to the documents. City officials have not confirmed whether the intersection the truck sped through was actively under construction, or said if the replacement project created a vulnerability. Some of the old bollards had proved unreliable and have been non-operational, the city said in a statement Wednesday afternoon. In the interim, white gate barriers have been used in those areas managed by the New Orleans Police Department to secure the street and regulate vehicle access for safety purposes. One day before New Year's Eve, New Orleans officials issued a traffic advisory about its vehicle barrier replacement project, stating that crews would work until 2 p.m. on Monday and try to minimize road closures as much as possible to reduce impacts during the celebration. Currently, Bourbon Street is fully open from Canal Street to Toulouse Street, the city said in its December 30th advisory. The intersection of Bourbon and Canal is where the pickup swerved around a police blockade and rammed into the mass of people. The driver was shot to death by police, and the FBI is investigating the incident as an act of terrorism, authorities said. As vehicle attacks have increased in recent decades, cities around the world have installed bollards in pedestrian-heavy areas. New York City has put up similar retractable steel columns around Times Square, City Hall, and Wall Street. They are also a common sight in other large cities such as London, Paris, and Tokyo. There have been proposals over the years to turn much of Bourbon Street into a pedestrian plaza, managed by a team focused on making it safe, Louisiana Lieutenant Governor Billy Nungesser said Wednesday. He told the Associated Press that it's important to examine every aspect of safety following the New Year's Day carnage. You can't prevent something like this when someone wants to kill people, Nungesser says. But I'm hoping we take a hard look at what we do, because there will be another one, whether it's in New Orleans or elsewhere. Addressing the removal of the bollards, Nungesser said, "How does that happen for a major event?" Initially installed beginning in December 2017 as part of a $40 million safety plan, the New Orleans bollard system consisted of four sets of barriers placed at either side of Bourbon Street intersections. The inner two columns can be pushed back when unlocked by a ground-level control panel, allowing for a roughly 13-foot, 4-meter, berth for vehicles to navigate through, NOLA.com reported when construction began. Aaron Miller, director of the city's Office of Homeland Security and Emergency Preparedness, said at the time that the bollards would go up nightly in keeping with city rules that close off stretches of the popular French Quarter Boulevard exclusively to pedestrians. Otherwise, they would be used only to block intersections either by a city ordinance or during special events, he said. The barriers were designed to mitigate against what we believe the risk is for pedestrians in a part of the city, he said, was an iconic or symbolic target, Miller said in December 2017. Wednesday's rampage happened amid the ongoing Bourbon Street Bollard Assessment and Replacement Project, which includes removing the old bollards, replacing concrete pavement, constructing concrete bases, installing metal sleeves for the new bollards, and repouring the roadway, according to the city's Wednesday statement. So far, 11 of the 16 bollard locations have been replaced, the statement said. Daily inspections monitor progress, and testing reports issued today confirm the required material strength has been achieved. On December 10th, the city posted a photo on social media of a torn-up street in the French Quarter with two bollards sitting atop a pallet. Work was scheduled to be completed by early February 2025, when New Orleans will host the Super Bowl, city records show. The project includes replacing old bollards with new removable stainless steel bollards and sidewalk repairs at various locations, a Department of Public Works document states. In a November 26th update, city officials said work including concrete pouring was occurring on both sides of Bourbon Street without closing intersections to vehicle traffic. Pistol-packing girlfriend gets probation. Decatur. The Decatur woman accused of ending an argument with her boyfriend by firing a warning shot from a handgun has been sentenced to 24 months of what's known as second chance probation. That means that if defendant Erica A. Webb, 28, follows the rules and stays out of trouble, she will be able to keep a felony conviction off of her record. The case against her dates to the night of August 11th, outside Webb's home in the 3400 block of Dove Drive. A sworn affidavit filed by the Decatur Police Department quoted neighbors as saying it was not unusual to hear arguments between Webb and her 33-year-old boyfriend, but this time the disagreement had been punctuated by the sound of a gunshot. Officers had questioned a neighbor who, moments before the shot was fired, had seen the boyfriend standing in Webb's front yard while she stood on the porch. The neighbor is then quoted as saying she heard the boyfriend yell out, "You're waving around a pistol. I should call the police on you," according to Officer Luke Roberts, who signed the affidavit. Webb is said to have replied, "I don't give a expletive," followed by the sound of a single gunshot. The 16-year-old told police she had heard gunfire before at other places where she had lived, and she knew the distinctive sound of a bullet being fired. Police arrived after neighbors called 911, but the boyfriend, found sitting in a car parked in the driveway of Webb's home, claimed nothing had happened and refused to say anything more. Roberts said Webb would not answer the door, but after repeated knocking, finally let officers inside. She also denied anything had happened and continued getting kids aged 9 and 4 ready for bed while police waited for a judge to sign a search warrant. That search turned up a live .22-caliber bullet on the floor of a bedroom, and police also found a full box of .22-caliber ammunition and a loaded .22-caliber handgun fitted with a light and laser sighting system. Roberts said Webb didn't have a FOID card and was not allowed to own a gun. The defendant was due to face a bench trial on charges of the reckless discharge of a gun and possession of a gun while her FOID card was revoked. But she appeared December 5th in Macon County Circuit Court and agreed to a plea deal that saw her admit charges of obstructing justice and the illegal possession of ammunition. Judge Rodney Forbes then dismissed the other charges against her. He also ordered Webb to pay $250 to have her DNA added to a crime database maintained by the state police. Driver died from natural causes, coroner says. The Decatur driver, whose body was found after a crash on the afternoon of Christmas Day, died from natural causes, not the crash itself, according to autopsy results. Donald Crawley Sr., 87, had been westbound in the 3600 block of East US 36 when his Chevrolet pickup truck went out of control. It veered off the road to the north and struck a sign and two utility poles before going southwest across the traffic lanes and hitting two more utility poles and finally came to rest in the 3500 block of the road. A statement issued Thursday by Macon County Coroner Michael Burkham said Donald Crawley Sr. died from natural causes on December 25th, which inadvertently caused the single vehicle crash that occurred at US 36 East and 36th Street in Decatur. The crash had been investigated by the Decatur Police Department's Fatal Accident Investigation Team. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review for January 3rd, 2025. Please stay tuned.